Looking for a foreign language program that will revolutionize your students' vocabulary knowledge and their understanding of grammar? How about a program that teaches critical thinking skills, too? Look no further than Memoria Press's Latin curriculum. Students of all ages can use these Latin study programs. Give your students the gift of Latin today. To order, visit memoriapress.com and save $5 on your next order by using the coupon code LPR20. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
If you stop and think about it, I guess in order to move your agenda ahead, if all is fair in love and war and we're in a culture war, then maybe calling someone a white nationalist when they really don't resemble one at all, or calling someone racist when really all they are is maybe white and Christian and pro-life, if all is fair in love and war, that kind of tactic might work for a while. But pro-lifers have often been equated with racism, the worst of white nationalism. Why is this? Our guest for the next few minutes says that if pro-lifers had their way, America would be a lot browner than it is. And since abortion supporters are getting their way, significant numbers in minority populations, African American and otherwise, have been simply aborted out of existence. So which one is in favor of white nationalism when it comes down to the population and the demographics? We're going to be talking about the left, abortion, racism, and charges of white nationalism. Mary Eberstadt joins us. She's senior fellow at the Faith and Reason Institute in Washington, D.C., author of numerous books, including her latest, Primal Screams, How the Sexual Revolution Created Identity Politics, and a recent column for The Federalist titled Left Insists Pro-Lifers Like Tucker Carlson Are Racist While Pushing Policies That Kill Black Babies. Mary, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
Why do genuine white nationalists despise the pro-life movement?
Well, they despise Christianity, for starters. And this is not well understood out there and needs to be. So in part, it's because of Christianity. And, of course, the biggest reason that white nationalism is completely at odds with the pro-life movement is that the pro-life movement is colorblind. The pro-life movement is about the sacred value of every single life, no matter what color. And, of course, if you're a white nationalist, what you want is to see fewer people of color. So that's where this contradiction comes in between the pro-life movement and white nationalism or racism.
So give us an example of how the left attempts to turn the tables on this subject and accuse pro-lifers of being white nationalists or racists.
Well, we've seen a couple of examples in the last few months, very unfortunate examples. A writer for the Washington Post tried to connect J.D. Vance, who is a Christian and the author of Hillbilly Elegy, with white nationalism. This writer egregiously misquoted something that J.D. Vance had said, in which he observed that we have a low birth rate and it would be good if we had more babies. And the writer twisted this to mean that he was talking about white babies, when of course he was doing no such thing. So that seems to have been a pilot for what's a wider attempt to smear the pro-life movement by tying it falsely to racism. Another example, and the one that I wrote about recently, is Tucker Carlson, who was smeared by a writer for the New York Times in the same way. The writer tried to somehow tie Tucker Carlson and populism into racism. Now, Tucker Carlson has been a very outspoken advocate for the unborn, and he's on record saying that he has personal reasons for this belief of his. So we have this irony, Todd, where if the pro-lifers had their way, America would be a browner and blacker place than it is today. And conversely, the progressive people who have had their way on abortion ever since Roe v. Wade are inadvertently but really creating a whiter America. It's a great paradox, and it needs to be pointed out.
You cite a couple examples of the leaders in the left, presidential candidates, even Supreme Court justices, betraying the notion that part of the goal of abortion on demand is, in fact, to keep certain populations under control. What are your examples?
Well, this goes back to the history of eugenics in America, and the most classic example here is, of course, Margaret Sanger. Margaret Sanger cynically worked with black ministers in black neighborhoods to try and keep down the population of the unfit. That was how she saw those people. And yet, no matter how many times that fact gets repeated, somehow the left has an escape hatch on this that they shouldn't have. Planned Parenthood still celebrates Margaret Sanger. Up until recently, they gave away monetary awards in her name to journalists who wrote pro-abortion pieces. So for some reason, she's immune to criticism, and she shouldn't be. And in bringing her up, I want to remind people of that history and just who stood on the side of lowering the numbers of dark people in this country. It wasn't the Christians. It wasn't the pro-lifers. It was the progressives.
Why are progressives so concerned about population in Africa and then, by extension, African-American and other minority populations in the U.S.?
That is a great question, Todd, and I wish I knew the answer. But there is this strange preoccupation with the fertility of certain other people, and these certain other people always turn out to be darker people. When Bernie Sanders, for example, raised the threat of overpopulation and talked about how we need more control, contraception, and abortion in the poorest countries. If you look at a list of the poorest countries, what you see is that they are almost all in Africa. This is about dark people. And, of course, he didn't make it explicit. He may not even be conscious of it. But when people like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, for example, go around the third world, the developing world, and try to push contraceptives on people, it is always in places where there are lots of brown and black people. And I think this is going to look really unpalatable. I think 50 years from now, when people look back on this time and they see all of this effort going into keeping down the number of dark people on the part of white people, coming from increasingly barren societies, I think this is going to look grotesque.
How does the term poverty get used as a proxy for race by progressives when it comes to their concerns about certain ethnicities' populations?
Well, of course, if people talk about poverty, then they're not alluding directly to race. And, of course, there is concern about poverty, and there are people who believe that making fewer Africans is a way out of poverty. Those of us in the pro-life movement obviously don't believe that. But poverty is also used as a smokescreen for race, for the reason that I just stated. If you look at the poorest countries in the world, they are almost all in Africa. So talking about poverty gets progressives out of the obvious problem that when they're talking about having fewer babies out there, they're invariably talking about brown and black babies.
They even speak about abortion as a tool to end poverty. That seems bizarre to my way of thinking.
Well, I think it is. And the idea that your first approach to someone from another culture would be to tell them that the world would be better with fewer people like them in it is pretty paradoxical, too, I think. I don't think progressives stop to wonder about what it feels like to be on the receiving end of that message, because no one is going around telling better off white people to make fewer of themselves. But somehow doing this in the case of darker people doesn't get called out. And that's why I wrote that piece, Todd, because I think that it's past time to call out this kind of thing.
What do you make of the fact that you have, I think you've mentioned it several times in the course of our conversations, and it was recently reported by the Charlotte Lozier Institute that in New York City in 2016, as in previous years, more African American babies were aborted than were actually brought to term and born alive.
It's a horrible fact. I mean, every abortion is a horrible fact. But it goes to show the success of the progressive agenda in these neighborhoods. Again, this goes back to Margaret Sanger and the eugenicist movement. They have had decades and decades to push contraception and abortion on populations that they think there is a little too much of. And I think what we're seeing in those dramatically high rates of abortion, especially in the inner city, is exactly that, that there's been a campaign that's been very successful to persuade, especially black people, to make fewer of themselves. So in that sense, progressivism has a victory, but it's a very tainted victory, and it can't help but be tainted by the race question.
How do the advocates for abortion in the left, how do they explain that abortion disproportionately targets black communities as opposed to white communities?
I don't think they even try to explain it. They don't seem very interested in the fact. And of course, for them, Todd, every abortion is a good abortion. We've seen these horrible, cold-blooded memes on the internet, like shout your abortion, you know, hashtag shout your abortion, tell your story, celebrate this thing. So I don't think most people on the left are particularly disturbed by the racial disparity because they think abortion is a good thing that is always and everywhere to be commended. Again, I find that a very cold-blooded attitude. You don't have to even be an absolutist about abortion to miss the cold-bloodedness of this thing.
So is there a way in public discourse that pro-lifers can shrug off this mischaracterization that progressives have labeled them with of being both racist and essentially white nationalist? Is there a way to do this, an argument that can be mounted in public discourse?
Well, I think so. And the way to do it is just to call it out and never sit still when people with bad intentions try to make this false connection between being pro-life and somehow being racist. If there is racism in this mix, it is not on the pro-life side. And I think the more we just patiently hammer away at that message, the more successful we're going to be and the more civil conversation is going to become. People out there have to realize that they can't randomly go calling people racist all the time without expecting repercussions.
Do you think that in African-American communities or Latino communities, the message of the progressive wing has traction when they see firsthand how their communities are affected by abortion and how the abortion industry targets them?
Well, I hope so. I'm sure it's a mixed bag out there. That said, there are deep pockets of religiosity in these same areas, in these same neighborhoods. And where there are convicted Christians especially, there is a deep understanding that religion is colorblind. Christianity is colorblind. Many sins have been committed in the name of Christianity, of course, and I'm not trying to sugarcoat any of that. But when it comes to the question of whether every life is a sacred life, no matter what color that life may be, the pro-lifers are on the right side of history and truth, and Christians know it, whether they are Hispanic or black or white or whatever else they may be. So Christians need to get together on this message, I think, and push back whenever this false association is made between the pro-life movement and racism or white nationalism.
Mary Eberstadt is senior fellow at the Faith and Reason Institute in Washington, D.C., author of numerous books, including her latest Primal Screams, How the Sexual Revolution Created Identity Politics, and a recent column for The Federalist titled Left Insists Pro-Lifers Like Tucker Carlson Are Racist While Pushing Policies That Kill Black Babies. You can purchase Primal Screams and find a link to Mary's website at issuesetc.org. Click Talk on Demand Archives. Mary, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
Live Friday on Issues Etc., we'll talk with international human rights attorney Dr. John Warwick Montgomery about a tribunal ruling against a British doctor who refused to use transgender pronoun. It's This Week in Pop Christianity with Pastor Chris Roseborough, and we'll play Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Repentance and forgiveness, sin and grace, law and gospel. More than cliches, real preaching for real people in need of hearing the real Christ. Christ for You and the Divine Service at St. Paul Lutheran Church of Hamel, Illinois, where we gather every Saturday night at 6 and on the Lord's Day, Sunday mornings at 7:45 and 10. Look for the Church of the Neon Cross on I-55 between exits 30 and 33. Find us on the web, stpaullutheranchurchhamel.org. St. Paul Lutheran Church of Hamel, where there is the forgiveness of sins, life and salvation for the people of God.
Gospel reductionism replaces the Bible as the source and norm of theology with the gospel. What would a gospel reductionist edition of Luther's Small Catechism look like? Find out in the latest Issues Etc. journal. We'll send it to you for free. Just click the red journal subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. In the Wittenberg Trail feature, Dr. Russell Dawn details his journey from Anglicanism to Lutheranism. The free online Issues Etc. journal, issuesetc.org.